Good, and with this, we're already 25 minutes ahead of schedule, so looks like a...
You'll have a lot of time.
It'll be, no, don't worry. I won't waste it. So, as you know, there are two kinds of abstract that one writes for talks. There's the kind that you write when you've already done the work, and the kind that you write when you're going later to do the work and then present your result. So when I wrote how good is good enough for gravitational waves from binary spiral, well, I wish I could tell you. In fact, after working on it for a week or so, looking around, doing my own assessment, I think that in truth, the honest assessment is that we don't know yet. We don't know how good will be good enough for gravitational wave templates. So instead, I'm going to give you a little bit of the motivation for doing all of this, show you how a data analyst, a gravitational wave data analyst, looks at the world and at this subject. And finally, look at hints in the literature and of how good could be good enough. So why solve the two-body problems in general relativity, and why do all the work that you've been doing? So I suppose you know this already when you lie awake at night and think all my work. But if nothing else, I can give you a picture of the why that can be useful to show to the funding agencies and to convince people that they should fund your research and really let you do this. So let's talk a little bit about the science from binary spirals. So this is the kind of slide that I actually show to general audiences when I want to introduce gravitational waves. What are they? Well, they're propagating fluctuations of space-time curvature emitted by massive bodies in rapid motion. And the idea is that people should, you know, watch that, concentrate on the rotating motion, and then after they've seen that, they actually believe everything that you're going to tell them later. But you don't need this. For you, just this, okay? That's all you need. It's what you do. It's what inspires you. Beautifully drawn by Chad, thanks to fine art, I suppose. So then, as you know, gravitational waves, there are big projects to detect them. Two of these are, one of these is the present, the other one is the future. So as you notice, the present, LIGO, this is the installation in Washington State, one of the two LIGO observatories. It's not such a great picture, whereas the future looks very bright. This is the Einstein telescope, the planned underground triangular triple interferometer facility in Europe. This is LISA, or a space-based detector. These are still in the future. And a theme in what I'm going to tell you later is that moving from detections of gravitational waves to doing science with gravitational waves and by determining, estimating the parameters of binary and spiral components. So the present and for the next few years is really about the detection. It's really about getting the first confirmed direct detection of gravitational waves. Hopefully somebody will get a call from Stockholm after. And also, hopefully, the first detection will unleash a flood of money to make these really powerful instruments that will really go deep, see signals in great detail, allow us to get the fine determination parameters. A little bit about the status of LISA. You might have heard a lot happened, not all of it good, over the last year. So what happened is that LISA for 10 years had been a joint European NASA mission with two projects going along with different responsibilities. NASA, every 10 years, the US astronomy prioritizes projects and efforts for the next 10 years. So LISA and space-based gravitational waves got a very high priority. However, NASA determined that pretty much all the money they have for astrophysics, they're going to need for the James Webb telescope. So effectively pulled out from the partnership with the Europeans. The Europeans then they decided to go alone at it and basically study whether a European-led mission done mainly with European resources could still be viable. So they're doing this early next year. In June at this point, European Space Agency will decide whether LISA will be the first of the large Cosmic Visions missions to be implemented by the agency. The competitors are an X-ray mission, again, one that used to be joint with the US and is going to be European alone, used to be called LIXO, and a planetary mission. So I would say at this point, the brightest prospect for space-based gravitational waves is that the European Space Agency adopts LISA. That could happen early next year. In the US, NASA said, okay, if the Europeans don't, let's do an exercise and let's see what kind of mission we could put in space. So they asked for inputs from the community. And I don't know if you saw this, there were 15 proposals of mission concepts, several of which still look like LISA and cost somewhat similar, some amount similar to LISA. Some are quite a bit different, and there's some atom interferometry, so some very futuristic stuff like that. There are some with different orbits, other ideas. The problem is that by the time you've put three spacecraft in space, which is what you need to do, interferometric gravitational wave detection, pretty much your sticker price is three quarters of a LISA. So there's not much that you could invent there. You could do a 100 million. 100 million is cheap, right, compared to LISA. You could do a 100 million mission that sees nothing and, you know, and puts a high upper limit, but that's not interesting, I think. So Europe is the hope. Otherwise, NASA will look at this concept, but we really think about it again in 2020 with the next decade. So, yes? Well, the Japanese are being very... Is there anybody from... I guess not. I've been very optimistic with that and pushing that. That was the SIGO Pathfinder and the first mission. But the SIGO would be higher frequency, right, than LISA. Also harder, a harder mission. They actually want to do to reflect photons in space as opposed to just sending couples of lasers back and forth. I think it's a very optimistic schedule, and a real cost on the SIGO is probably huge to actually get to the final mission. So. Again, let's say we're talking about the 2020s or late 2020s at best. So I hope they can keep pushing on it. They have a big group, a very, very enthusiastic, a very good minds. Yes?
Can you comment on that grant? There was a proposal last week on the archive, an American proposal.
There are actually two Lagranges, which is kind of fun, because out of 15 missions, there were two with the same name, which obviously puts one or more spacecraft at Lagrange points. So the one I know best, I don't know if that's the one you're looking at.
The triangle around the Earth.
Okay, so that's the one I don't know. They're both triangles around the Earth. One is has the Earth-Sun Lagrange, and two more at like 60 degrees. The other one has Earth-Moon. So I think that one is a spherical test mass, longer arms proposal. So in a way, it's basically the same concept as LISA. So drag free operation, follow the motions of freely falling test masses, and so what one of the now there's a 10 people group, a community science team has been formed, which has some of the usual faces, but I think the chair may be Ray Weiss of LIGO fame, who's going to try to put all the concepts on the same plot as far as sensitivity and therefore science, and also on the same spreadsheet as far as cost. So we'll see to that. I think in a way many of these concepts are similar, and getting into space and far enough is really the main challenge there. So now these are the standard talking points about gravitational waves. So one thing I can tell you, we're saying detection versus parameter estimation, is that actually last year there was already a gravitational wave event with a name attributed to it, and this was called Big Dog because the sky position for this event was put in the Canis Major, right, constellation. And these were the traces for this event. These are time frequency plots, so time frequency. These are the familiar chirps that you expect to see from any spiral event, two neutron stars or two black holes. This is Virgo, right, the two LIGOs and Virgo. Virgo didn't see quite as much. So there was some excitement associated with this, but it was a blind injection, so this was a fake event injected into LIGO data. What was the point to this exercise? If you go back to March of last year, actually at the LIGO collaboration meeting, there was a somewhat formal ceremony of opening an envelope. Champagne was served first, then this envelope would either say no extra extraneous signal was put into the detector data, therefore you found aerial gravitational waves, or it would say, as it did, that a what was it, 5 plus 10 black hole and spiral event?
Three and 20
was injected into the signal. The point was to run an internal exercise and to for the collaboration to convince itself that had there been a real event, they would have been able, A, to find it, and B, to agree that they have found it, and to come up with enough confidence to tell the external world and to announce this as a real event. So the process was really run through all the way, actually to writing a paper, a physical review letters, if you must know, announcing the detection. There was a special committee set up to validate the detection. Among the things that he considered was whether a hoax could have been done that produced the where somebody secretly would have put this in the data. It also shows some interesting aspects of doing data analysis. So the injection was found, but there were a few glitches. One was that in one of the interferometers in Livingston, actually the signal was put in with the wrong sign. So effectively, the entire interferometer was flipped from the point of view of the injection. So this was just a bug, let's say. Another aspect was that the injection was made at 2 p.m. using, well, because the experimentalists who did it figured 2 p.m. had been good enough for many years, so why not? But the search was done at 3.5 p.m., so with the highest circular conservative terms. So the parameters that were found were actually quite wrong, also for the spin flip, but also for this error.
Will the real signal be 2 p.m. or 3.5?
To be infinite. Or 10 p.m. at least. So that's for detection. As for parameter estimation, so this is the standard inspirational plot where you see the three communities coming together to make one gravitational wave spiral template. So, you know, post-Newtonian calculations perturbative in the adiabatic or quasi-adiabatic spiral, then going into a merger, that's the province of numerical relativity, and then ring down, which is easy, I guess, is against perturbative physics. So up until 2005, when the first successful simulation, numerical relativity simulation was made, this plot would have looked like that. So that was the original Kipps constant of the merger. And you can see the imagination of a merger was quite a bit more dramatic than the actual physics of a merger than it's turning out to be. But when people say we need to do numerical relativity, they were thinking of something like this crazy nonlinear behavior with you know, space-time shooting off in all directions. These waveforms are always the scale with mass, total mass of the space-time is the only scale. So to go to a bigger black hole, you just scale up your signaling time, which means that the same template can be used for different detectors and for different science. For ground based, for instance, if you take two small Newton stars, what you see is basically this initial part. If you take a heavier, say 20 solar mass black hole binary, you start seeing the merger and the ring down. And a very heavy black hole binary, you basically see only the final part. Now, what kind of science can you get from in spirals? The point is that as a data analyst, I don't see this as the solution on equations. I see this as the vehicle, as the as a carrier of interesting information about the parameters, the physical parameters of the system of the binary that generated it. So the spiral will tell me about the binary masses, spins, and orientations, typically. And the final part, the merger ring down, about the final black hole. And there's a crazy, there's a huge amount of science you can do with just parameters from binaries. You can do astrophysics, you can look at binaries in the galaxies and see how they evolve through you know, common envelope. What could be the progenitors of supernovae and GRB in the solar system? For big black holes, the big black holes at the center of galaxies, what was their origin, how they grew through accretion, through mergers? You can do cosmology within spirals because actually one of the signal encodes the absolute luminosity distance to the system. And if you can see a electromagnetic counterpart, some kind of flash that goes with the final merger, you can get a redshift, perhaps, from the galaxy where you isolate a thing, and then luminosity versus redshift, well, that's a point on the Hubble diagram. It tells you about cosmology. You can test strong field GR, for instance, by looking at ring down modes. A single one of these tells you about the mass and the spin parameter of the final black hole. You get two of them. You can already test whether it's really a Kerr black hole they're ringing. You can check whether those parameters are compatible with the parameters measured earlier from the spiral. You can do nuclear physics if you have matter, typically Newton stars in this case. You can see the effect of hydrodynamics in the final, in spiral tidal transfers on energy. You can test the alternative theories of gravity, again, because these gravitational waves will be the first direct test of the radiation sector, as you may call it, and of really strong field. Now, just one example. Let me go in a little depth about just a single science case point, a single science case item, which is supermassive black holes. So if you look around us in the galaxy, there are big black holes pretty much in every nearby galaxy. We can tell they're there by looking at the motion of stars and gas around them. The best constrained example is actually our own galaxy, the galactic center, where the orbits of giant stars around the center have been followed through, I think at this point, 15 years. And you can tell that they follow very beautiful ellipses. And actually, the ellipse tells you the mass and the compactness of essential objects, which really looks like a black hole. But also, in all big galaxies around us, we see the presence of a big black hole. We see the presence of this black hole from early as a redshift of 6 in the light from quasars, and so active galactic nuclei, excited mass around the central black holes. In fact, we see so much light coming from afar that we can barely explain it in terms of the black holes that we know now exist. These are big things, 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 solar masses. And these black holes have a very intimate relation with the galaxy they inhabit. This is one of these famous mass velocity plots. All these blobs are galaxies with different types of measurements of the mass of the central black hole. And you can tell that the mass of the central black hole has a very tight correlation with the mass of the total galaxy, and especially a good correlation with the velocity, the dispersion velocity of the stars around it. So how this is possible? This means that black holes and galaxies must have evolved together. One speaks of coevolution of black holes, massive black holes and galaxy, and there are hierarchical merger scenarios in which galaxies first merge, and then the two nuclear black holes find each other, make a binary, and eventually merge. To observe these directly in gravitational waves will tell us a lot of things. For one thing, we see now the big black holes that make enough light, and as early as Eox 6, very big black holes, but they have to have gotten there somewhere. So how did you make the original black holes? Well, maybe you would have had to make small ones, seed black holes, either from population 3 stars, these very heavy early stars, 100 solar masses and more, or maybe by directly collapsing gas in these initial dark matter halos and proto-halos. Then how did they grow? Did they grow mainly through, we know they grew mainly through accretion. They grew too much to be just by mergers, just by summing up their individual masses. So they must have eaten up lots of gas and matter from the galaxies. But was this accretion mainly through a disk, orderly, or through chaotic incidents of mass going in at all angles? Well, we'll know this very well because disk accretion really spins up central black holes and would lead to observed spins very close to maximal for the black holes. Chaotic, instead, would keep it somewhere in the middle, kind of random walk-like. And finally, this is the big question, the efficiency question. After you merge a galaxy, the two black holes eventually find each other, but it would take them an incredibly long time to actually merge if the shrinking of their spiral was due only to gravitational waves. You need the help of gas, and you need the help of stars around them to actually create friction and make them be a challenge not to yawn after seeing a big yawn. So they need the help of stars and gas to actually form merging binaries. So we don't know the efficiency of this process, and therefore we don't know the rates. We don't know the expected rates for this object. But for something like LISA, a space-based interferometer, you expect from a few to hundreds even per year. And the other science case I was going to give you briefly is about testing GR. I must say that although in Europe especially testing fundamental physics with gravitational waves was brought forth as one of the main reasons to do gravitational wave detection and to do space-based detection especially, theoretically I think it's less well developed than a lot of the rest. mainly because I think experimental GR is kind of stuck in the 70s when you know, Cliff Will wrote his seminal at this point book. And I think experimental gravity has a very standard model, let me put it this way. You start from the principle of equivalence, which is tested really accurately on the ground. You add you know, Lorentz invariance, and at that point, pretty much, you have to do a metric theory. And once you're doing a metric theory, there's not much that you can do that's very different from GR. Sure, you can have other modes for gravitational wave, other polarizations. You can have a scalar vector tensor theory as opposed to just a metric, which also leads to consequences for emission, so not just quadrupole emissions, possibly dipole emission. And you could perhaps change the dispersion relation for gravitational waves. This is a somewhat phenomenological insertion in the theory, but you could do that. But these kind of changes, actually, they affect also the conservative weak field sector of the theory, which is tested really, really well in the solar system, and to some extent with binary pulsars. So sure, you can use gravitational waves to test Brunz-Dickey theory, but you don't get such an exciting sensitivity over what you can do already. This part of the slide, it's a little different. So this is not quite the fundamental theory we're testing. We're testing cosmology. So this is a plot of how well using, let's see, four advanced ground-based interferometers and GRB counterparts, so Newton-star-Newton storm mergers from which you also get the GRB, how well you could measure distances compared to the true ones. And this kind of slope then is the gives you the Hubble constant to a few percent with some 20 or 30 detections. So this is the case for doing cosmology with gravitational waves I was telling you about. And then, of course, black hole hair, right? The basic relation for the Gerok multiples for a Kerr black hole. So all the mass and current quadrupole multiples of your geometry are entirely determined from the mass and spin parameters of a central Kerr black hole. If you see, using space-based detectors, an inspiral of a small body into a big one, you can measure the first few of these multiples and then basically constrain this relation and see whether it's a really a Kerr object that you have at the center of the galaxy. You can do a similar game, again, with the ring-down modes, the thing I was showing you before. So this is not quite testing the fundamental theory. It's more testing like the standard paradigm that you have GR and you have the Kerr black holes that are just Kerr and not something weird like boson stars or something exotic like that. So then the skepticism about then this testing fundamental physics is that, well, perhaps it's not as well developed as other part of it. There's this standard model that constrains you to what you can do. And in truth, you know, if you go back to the time where gravitational waves were indirectly measured through the Taylor-Hulse pulsar, there were other theories there in the game, in metric theories, perhaps with the absolute object, like a second metric. Those were excluded already by the verification of the quadrupole formula. After you've done that, the classic theories are mostly set. So what you can do certainly is a test of the self-consistency of GR. For instance, this is one of the examples where you'd be measuring individual post-Newtonian coefficients as if they were independent, as if they were not all functions of the same two masses and so on of the black holes. So you can see whether they're individually consistent, that if they are basically consistent with each other and they all follow the post-Newtonian relations that you expect. This would be a null test of general relativity. And also, there are some attempts right now, such as this parameterized post-Einstein framework, to just expand phenomenologically the waveforms that you expect to see from inspirals and to try to measure these phenomenological deviations. So there's certainly work going on here. And as Ricardo was pointing out just 20 minutes ago, there's a lot of work to do here. The skepticism is that with what we had already, I think we've sold it very well. Comment?
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, you published a recent paper. It's 2 weeks old. Actually, we showed that with the Nikkei group, we showed that indeed one can detect, assuming a specific phenomenological parameterization of the phasing, one can detect even wild deviation, phenomenologically wild deviation from GR. And that's in principle a framework that can be developed. Of course, that's only the first step. Of course, we haven't included spins and, you know, other sources of parameters and masses that can change the game. But I mean, it's starting now and it is promising.
And one thing I should say, since we have Luke here, is also that when I was reviewing this thing, I actually ended up not looking much at Perez. So if you have a comment here, or later in comment period, that would be well.
Perez predicts PPN parameters which are different from GR, and notably the preferred frame parameters, which are non-zero in Perez, which is certainly very much tested in the solar system.
As far as the gravitational wave sector.
Yeah, I have seen a paper trying to test TBS with gravitational waves. There are some papers on that.
Okay.
Sorry, can I make my point here in one second? I mildly disagree with the second bullet.
Okay, so principal frameworks are beginning to exist.
Yeah.
Okay? For radiation systems. Very good. Yes?
Can you go back to the baseline?
Yes.
Sorry. I like also to disagree with the sentence in parentheses.
Look, for 8:30, it's great. You all had your coffee, yes.
Just a one note, because what you have been able to test with Hal Steiner is really just the bug order.
Yes.
In GR, of course, but B over C to the power of infinity.
Yes.
These psi 6 and psi 7 are corrections that are absolute order V to C power 12. So even the facing of Hals Taylor does not test the very first psi 2 of those coefficients, which is the first undetected, because psi 0 is consistent with Hals Taylor.
No, no, I agree with that.
So
and
it's both the framework that exists as Ricardo says, because he's an expert, and the second part that
So, well, the distinction here is between phenomenological framework for waveforms and actual alternative theories. So what I say here, the best ones is theories where you start with an action, with a certain number of invariant fields, and then you go all the way and derive consequences for the quadrupole formula and for emission. So then things like the bimetric theory, Rosen and things like that, those were killed by Hals-Taylor-Poisson because they don't predict even the quadrupole formula. And the link between, changing these parameters and changing the action of the theory at this time is a little weak, or at least you don't really have it. One interesting exercise is what you did, which is to change the coefficients of the individual diagrams, Feynman diagrams in the nonlinear reactions. I guess from there you could go back and change the action, possibly, and see what that is. So you can also, there are certainly many ways to do this. So let me proceed, though. So detection and parameter estimation. What follows is a tutorial on data analysis meant for very early in the morning. So it's done only with addition and subtraction. And so you can go to sleep again, basically, the way I do it. But so data is signal plus noise. Experimentally, this is actually not obvious, but okay, let's assume our noise is additive. So a real gravitational wave is coming to your detector, and the detector through, it's generally not being nice, adds quite a bit of noise on top of it. So what you see is something like this. This is a simple, it's a sine Gaussian. Let's say it's a prototypical signal here. So how do you ask the question whether there's really a signal, whether you're detecting something? Well, you can say if data is signal plus noise, then noise must be data minus signal. And I kind of know the noise. If I see a certain noise, I can tell how probable that noise is. So if I see this in the detector, is this just noise? Or is it noise minus signal? So which one is more probable? Is it just noise more probable, or is it something minus the signal probable? In this case, this don't look very different, but it turns out that this kind of detector data would be a lot more probable than this one. The ratio of the two probabilities, the likelihood actually, would be something like 300,000. So this would actually be a pretty strong detection of this, although it doesn't look so great. Now, you tend to want pretty big probabilities because you're not just testing for this one. You're testing for many different possible shapes or signal that you may get from different systems. So there's kind of a trial ratio here. Still, this would be a pretty strong detection. So subtraction, but actually, if you allow me multiplication, I think this can be understood better. And in the terms of in which you tend to hear detection being talked about, which is match filtering. So if you take a signal and multiply it by yourself, well, you get a definite positive function. And if you integrate it, you get a number, some finite big number. Instead, if you multiply the same deterministic nice signal function by just noise, well, you get something that's noise-like, basically a random walk. And if you integrate this, it's going to be smaller. So basically what you do is in detection is compare these two numbers. If there is really no signal in the data, then this product of data with your theoretical signal is going to cluster around zero, some small value. If there really is a signal, it's going to cluster around a big value. And then the discrimination between these two, you set a threshold, you set how high you need to go before you believe that there's a signal and that these two distributions are separated, is what sets how far you can look, how strong a signal you need before you can detect it. And typically you see products like this, right? Just the data times the signal. This is match filtering. Now, science required that not only we tell that there's a signal in the data, but also that we be able to tell which are its parameters. So these are variants along two parameters of this simple sine Gaussian. And therefore, the game is basically the same again. So once you know there's a signal, you say, OK, this is the data I measured. I try to subtract different signals. Which of these noises is going to be most probable? Well, this one, really, the least noisy. So this is going to be my maximum likelihood estimate of the parameters, which is going to be a little different from the real signal, but usually close enough. Now, what happens, however, you see these curves all the time also. These are sensitivity curves for detector. What happens is that noise is frequency dependent. If you take a Fourier transform of everything, you see that you have a stronger component of noise at low and high frequencies. The way I like to describe this is that is the opposite of the usual proverb, is that things have to get better before they get worse again. And typically, both for space-based and for ground-based, the type of, at low frequency, you have noise that really shakes around your freely falling reference masses for your measurements. So in space, it would be acceleration noise. On the ground, it may be thermal noise or micro-seismic noise. At high frequency, you're limited by the optical senses, by the actual measurement of the relative position of your masses. Now, because of this, the game of looking for signal in noise changes a bit depending where you sit in frequency space in the sensitivity curve of your detector. So let's take the same LISA noise that I made here with more or less this frequency characteristic, lower noise at mid frequencies. And if you look at signals, monochromatic signals of different frequencies on top of it, you'll see that in the time domain, more or less, they all look hidden in here, the red signal. But in the frequency domain, you actually have a much better contrast, a much better discrimination for the mid frequency signal that sits in the middle here where there's almost no noise. This kind of considerations that you should work in, you work better in the bucket, as they say, here where sensitivity is best, is encapsulated in this formula, which is perhaps the single one formula that we see the most in data analysis. This is, I would say, maybe the equivalent of the quantum relations for states of the linear oscillator, of the harmonic oscillator, something like that. It's on every single paper you find this. What's this? This is just the product that we were doing before between two signal or between data and signal, but it's in the frequency domain, and it's weighted by noise so that you give more weight to the parts of the signal that sit in the range of best detector sensitivity. OK, so let's go into how good is good enough. So let's set up first some metrics of how good is good enough. What happens if the model, the theoretical model that you make of a certain waveform from an inspiral, say, is not exact? There's some theoretical error there. Well, in terms of detection, you're going to multiply a certain two signal with something that's a little bit different. So you see here the shape is a little different. So the product that you get is not quite positive definite. And the integral that you make of your correlation product is going to be a little less. This histogram in the plot is going to be pushed this way towards noise. And in effect, you'll need a stronger signal to push this back again above your threshold, which means that you won't see as far. Signal goes down as one over distance, as most things. And if you don't see as far, you're going to lose a number of events that are roughly proportional to the cube of how far you don't see. Now, cosmology, if you can see far enough, actually cosmology helps you because this tree goes down a little. But still, that's why you want to try to keep a metric like this as close to one as possible. This is a product of a signal with its best approximation among your theoretical shapes, normalized by the strength of both signals. So this would be known as a fitting factor. In terms of parameter estimation, it's actually easiest for me to take a geometrical point of view and describe it like this. Let's say this is the manifold of true signals, the infinite PN, the signals of nature. And down here, this is the manifold instead of the functional forms that your theory up to, 3.5 PN gives us. So for a certain true signal, the detected shape, what you think you have, is going to have slightly different parameters because of this error in the waveforms. It won't be the approximate signal with exact same parameters. It will be something a little displaced. And now, by contrast, the error that you get from just statistics for noise pushing you around is proportional to 1 over SNR, these dimensions of numbers I was showing you before, 25 if you square it, but this error due to from theory is actually independent from SNR. It doesn't matter how strong this is. You're going to make the same error if you have only approximate templates, approximate signal models. So what one does in practice is then to say, I'm going to have a certain jiggling around, a certain displacement from the manifold true signal just due to detector noise. This should be small compared, I'm doing it backwards. The theoretical error that you do, because you don't have exact waveform, should be small or comparable to the statistical error that you make because noise is pushing you around in the space of signals. This has motivated these two criteria for telling that the waveform is good enough, which are this norm here is a correlation norm, just the signal times itself divided by noise square root. This basic distance in signal space that we've been using so far and that tells you how strong something is. So the relative error then should be smaller than the error you can make from you're going to make from statistical noise alone if you're worrying about parameter estimation. If the point to doing the detection is to doing theoretical model is to do as well as you can in determining physical parameters. On the other hand, if you're just happy with detection, we're looking at the other thing that I showed you before, fitting factor. You just want not to lose too much distance in the detections that you're going to make. You don't care if you make some kind of parameter error. So you have different criteria on the error that you allowed. Typically, for detection, you can lose a few percent. Half a percent would be a conservative number. For parameter estimation, it really depends what kind of detector, what kind of experiment you're going to do. For the initial advanced LIGO detections, the strength, the contrast of the signal with respect to noise is going to be only of order 10. You can look at it as a 10 sigma detection if you want, which sounds very, very high until you consider that you're perhaps testing 100,000 different signal shapes for a year. So for 10 to the 6 independent parameters. For the best detections with advanced detection, so you'd be at the order of 100. And for space-based, we're in the thousands. Signals from supermassive black holes are actually very, very strong. Now, the problem is that this kind of thing, this kind of error on the waveform, is a little hard to relate to the error that you can make on the amplitude and on the phasing of the template. So you can write it like this. But this average error on logarithmic amplitude and phase, if you write your using something like a stationary phase approximation, if you write your template in the frequency domain, need to be weighted before they go into this expression, because you need to take into account that the strength of the signal changes across the spiral, and then the noise of the detector changes at different frequencies. This is the reason why it's hard to go from PN expressions where you just look at the amplitude of a coefficients in the post-Newtonian expansion, say for a phasing, to this kind of measurements that are useful for data analysis. Nevertheless, people have tried, so I'm going to show you a few examples of this test. And the place where these tests are being done is in the interface to numerical relativity. As I was showing you before, the way to get the best science and the best and the most detection is actually to merge the spiral signal from post-Newtonian calculations into a merger signal from a numerical relativity simulation and then a ring down. The way you do this, there are two ways really to do such a merging. One is hybrid waveforms, actually to splice together a post-Newtonian waveform with a numerical relativity, either waveform or a numerical relativity fit. Or as Alessandra will tell us in the next talk, you can build a dynamical model from first principles, let's say, of the entire spiral merger ring down, and then calibrate that using numerical relativity simulations. So this paper is concerned with the first kind of attempts. And then you have to worry, where do I do the splicing? Where is it that I end the post-Newtonian spiral and start the numerical spiral? Well, one thing you can do is actually to test the self-consistency of such hybrid waveforms. So there's a lot to take in this graph, so let's go a little slowly. But so here we're looking at post-Newtonian spirals tailored T3. This is one of these code words used in the community. What tailored T3 is one way of solving the adiabatic problem for an spiral. So if you assume that you're in a circular spiral that is changing slowly, and basically there's only one parameter that defines it, the instantaneous frequency, then the orbital frequencies are related to this effectively, let's see, this is B squared, right? So orbital frequency to the 1/3 is V over C. Phase, what you need for the waveforms is just that the derivative of phase is given there by the frequency. And there's an energy balance equation where the flux of energy at infinity for a certain orbital frequency is divided by the derivative of orbital energy by velocity. So these two together give you the evolution of the velocity and therefore of the phase. Now, these two are post-Newtonian expansions. They're given as polynomials in X. So once you have these equations, how do you solve it? Well, one way is just you write it as it is. You have this as a post-Newtonian expansion up to X to the 7, let's say, for 3.5 pn. The same for this, and you just solve it numerically. Or you could take this ratio, re-expand it as a Taylor series, cut it off at a nominal post-Newtonian order, and effectively you're doing something that should be equivalent, but when you do it at a high enough velocity, it's not. It just looks different. Hence why there are different ways of doing in spirals using adiabatic approximations. Another one maybe to rewrite all of this in the frequency domain, and then solve it not as a function of t, but as a function of instantaneous frequency, so of x. Now, what this graph shows then is if you take this kind of PN spirals and you splice them with a numerical relativity waveform at a certain gravitational wave frequency, given here in a dimensionless way by multiplying with a black hole, and then you compare it with something that's spliced at an earlier frequency, right? So if you're doing this early enough, it shouldn't matter if you do it a little earlier. You should be getting basically the same signal because post-Newtonian and black hole at that frequency are equivalent. Yet, you get a certain error if you do that. So if you start at 0.6, which is, by the way, so here you have at 0.06 for this frequency, you still have 10 gravitational wave cycles to go, so 5 orbits. VOC 0.1 here, so it's moderately high. So if you start here, you see that you made a huge error compared to what you do if you started earlier. So you can regress back, and you can compare to T4. Taylor T4 is a very lucky way of doing the splicing that seems to fit very well in numerical relativity. Basically, this seems to give you asymptotes for these curves. And what this graph tells you is that it really pushes you back. This splicings have been done with a 15 orbit and numerical relativity waveform, which is really pushing where you can get. It takes probably a few months of computer time, 1 month, but on a cluster to do this thing. So if you were to push it back to 30 orbits before merger, you'd be looking at 4 times as much time. So that's really a lot. But it seems that's what would be needed to achieve this kind of parameter estimation criteria, to have a merged spliced waveform that are good enough to do parameter estimation. So this is the pessimistic view of it, which tells you really we need either much longer numerical relativity simulations or higher order, hopefully higher order post-Newtonian in spirals that will match numerical relativity better and will match each other better. Yeah. Now, yes?
I just wanted to say that, I mean, this criterion is, I think, very stringent, maybe more than what we need, because it doesn't tell you what is the bias in the parameters.
Yeah, so.
And which are the parameters that are affected by the bias.
So then there's an optimistic view, which is more what you're saying, which is the following, saying, okay, so here we're just comparing the, say, exact numerical relativity waveform with the approximated one that we're making by splicing together post-Newtonian numerical relativity. That's relevant if you want to get perfect parameter estimation. What if you allow, if you allow yourself to change parameters, so to detect a certain signal using an approximated waveform that has slightly wrong parameters? So we're optimizing this fit, the match between the two, by moving in the signal space. So if you do that, actually, you improve your mismatch, which is just the square of the measure I was telling you before. So if before you were looking at mismatches of 10, 20, 30%, where you're just comparing for the same parameter, if you allow yourself to change the parameter a little, you're going to a range where you feel safe at least about detection, and where the error in parameters that you make is not that big. So that's what Alessandro is saying. This is true at least for some masses or for some spin parameters. So this exercise that Ome and others did using aligned spins and a range of masses, I think, for advanced ground-based interferometers, so between maybe 20 and 100, they did also for a range of mass ratios, 1 to 1 to 1 to 4, and for a range of this, this is the average weighted spin parameter that tells you how much the black holes are spinning, basically, dynamically in the system. So this area would be fine. There are still regions going outside, either toward the more extreme mass ratio, so lopsided systems with a light and a heavy black hole, or higher spins, where it seems that additional precision or longer simulations would be needed. Now, the question is, would additional post-Newtonian orders really help? There was an interesting couple of papers here that tried to answer this question by looking at extreme mass ratio systems. Unfortunately, the answer is a little inconclusive. But the idea was cool, which is we know that formally the post-Newtonian expansion is an asymptotic expansion, asymptotic series to the solution of the equation. So maybe it does something like the Bessel function that you see here. So if we take expansions at different orders in 1 over x of the Bessel function, the exact is the black, you see that as we go up in order, actually the error is smaller. So at the higher x here, you make a much smaller error with higher orders. However, these approximations diverge earlier from the true function. So if you want to look far enough from the perfect regime, you may be better off with the lower order approximation than with the higher one. So one could worry that in the post-Newtonian case, well, maybe in this case where velocities are high enough that 4pn would not help you because it diverges more badly than 3pn at the velocity where you need it.
How? 7 terms is 3.5k.
Oh, this is just Bessel, just the Bessel modified Bessel function. So this is just the idealized case just for analysis. And the point is that when you look at the APN, it doesn't look like that. It looks very confusing. So So in a plot like this, you can come up with a regional validity. So the regional validity for any given perturbation order is how far you can go and use it effectively. It's set formally by where the remainder, so the error that you make compared to the true solution, is of the same order of the next term in the asymptotic series. So you can try to determine that for the expansion of the flux. And for emrys, right, for extreme acceleration spiral, you actually have an exact flux that you get from computing the Tsiolkovsky equation for just perturbations of a black hole. And so as a function of velocity normalized by the velocity of the ISCO, you see that as we go up in order, so this would be 1pm, 1.5, 2, 2.5, and 3, basically it looks like the regional validity may be, so let's see, V over V ISCO, maybe growing and then going down again and then growing. So really can't really see a trend on this. And therefore, yes, 3.5 PN, especially in spin and 4 PN, may yet help. We just have to see and beyond. So my guess is that getting complete 3.5 waveforms with spins into the conservative energy in the flux in the amplitude corrections will certainly improve comparisons with numerical relativity and improve the precision that you can rely on when you do such matchings. Eventually 4PN, orbital terms, probably also. And there are some hints, but as my friend Emanuele said, this is the kind of plots where you can read whatever you want to read in them. However, let me give this to you for how much, for what they're worth. So in this plot compares different, again, approximants, different ways of solving this adiabatic equation. So Taylor T1 is integrating this directly. Taylor T4 is re-expanding it in expanding the ratio as a series in the velocity. And Taylor T4 truncated is where you say, well, these expressions include the 3.5 PN terms in the orbital dynamic sector of it, but only up to 2.5 PN since they hadn't yet included your new corrections. So when we're expanding them, maybe we should kill all the spin-related terms that come in at 3 and 3.5 PN because they're not complete. So there's some argument that the error in phasing that you make improves if you do include these partial spin terms that you that are formally at higher order. So there's a hint that completing them should help phasing error at the kind of orbital frequencies where you compare with numerical relativity. Another input here, which as Alessandra was telling me this morning, it's a little hard to assess because it's the way Campanelli and company do waveforms is a little different than the way most people do it. However, what they show is that they can match waveforms from numerical relativity in an evolution with generic spins, so not just aligned, but some configuration which will actually give you interesting precession, much better using 3.5 non-adiabatic post-Newtonian equations. So these actually, they're actually solving the equation of motion here rather than the 2.5. So I leave this for you to for discussion then, on top of my guess. So how good is good enough? So, well, 10 PN would be good enough, okay? Okay, 5, as much as you can do. Or it's never good enough. Keep doing this and program huge computers that are going to spend until the end of the universe, doing higher and higher multiples. And, not a great answer, but this is what it will be. We'll know it when we get there. So once we have 3.5 complete spins and 4, we will repeat the kind of analysis that I showed you before. You check against numerical relativity. You may be able to say for the domain of applications where this is needed, for advanced interferometers, and then for space-based, this would be enough or not. And then on to 5. Yes?
Let me be the devil's advocate. What's the possibility that 0 PN would be enough?
No, because then there is no radiation.
No, I'm talking about Newtonian radiation.
0 and 2.5, yeah.
The quadrupole. I'm talking about the quadrupole. Just doing a Fourier transform, and getting the...
Is it just a Newtonian chirp?
And, and noticing periodic signal.
Well, yeah, chirps. Well, can you get? Could you get strong advanced LIGO signal? Maybe.
No, but you get your fitting factor is going to drop.
Your fitting factor is going to drop to maybe 50%.
Well, but it depends
or,
on the
less.
Source.
Then you won't see.
The source, right? If you're talking about white neutron stars, it might be good enough. So you're thinking of black holes, but
no,
yeah. In fact, can I say what?
Please, please, it's discussion.
I think, I mean, this was very nice.
Yeah.
But it's true, as Luis said, that if you consider neutron stars, I mean low mass, even low mass black hole, what you know, the PPM, 3.5 PPM, is good enough for detecting and doing for parameter estimation. So that maybe should be said. I think what you are talking when you compare the numerical relativity is really the last part, is the last, you know, 20 cycles, 40 cycles. But for neutron stars, we have templates, we can detect them.
Yeah.
I think that should be said.
That's what makes them boring, though. You don't see the merger. Yeah,
I
you know,
think
we,
it's important to
no.
Sometimes
you think the first iteration of gravitational waves
is good.
Important.
Yeah, who cares? So no. Newton's tiny little sub-binary certainly have a value as your guaranteed, you know, theoretically guaranteed template. So yes, we know we can do them. That's why maybe the first source you detect is also the only source that we actually know exists in the galaxy and beyond, because we know of a few Newton star binaries. We don't know of any Newton star black hole binary or black hole binary, just from astrophysics, from astronomy. So definitely, you can do that. But that has no merger, has almost no strong GR. So
well, Ita, if you go to 3PN, as you know, you do have a lot of contribution from non-linear ETs from GR. So
but with advanced LIGO at the lower scenario, can you see 3PN on a
If you do the parameter estimation, you can do what you suggest by measuring by match filtering the coefficients, and then you can get a test of the non-linearities of GR.
Well, but if you're saying that Newtonian is good enough,
no,
right?
No.
For parameter estimation, it is.
Yeah. But they're linked, parameter estimation and detection. So if the fitting factor is very low, sure, but...
No, go ahead, but I can add something to this.
Please do.
Okay, one thing is that if you have a screwed up template, if the signal is strong enough, still the base factor will pop up and it will tell you that something is going on. You might be very off in determining both the source parameter and the GR parameter, but still you can get the detection.
Yes.
But what I mean is that, I mean, present test of GR, they all test the 1PN conservative and the leading dissipative. And they are all around the 1 million kilometer scale. So there is huge space for testing and constraining. But actually, to go and check that the 3PN is what actually GR predicts. In a source where you don't know the intrinsic parameters, well,
but for neutron star binaries, you have to know the masses. The spins will be very small. So
yes, but then
this is well, very well.
Yeah, but then we never know if you have matter around.
Oh, this is very, very small.
But
effect.
The matter is at high frequencies,
yes.
400, you know, 200 hertz at minimum. So you see the inspired part, the matter effect is not important.
But this is a question we can probably look up in the literature and. It's done somewhere. So see, if you take a Newton star, it's an hour of 10, and see which PM parameters you see. But you can determine. I think it's a well-defined question. So it's very possible. Yes.
I think that conclusive studies are actually. I don't know conclusive studies about the precision you can get with the 3PN. I mean, people are studying this now. I mean, I qualitatively it should be possible, but I don't know what it is.
With the people from Arun, Satya, and that.
Yes,
this plot that you showed.
No, but I think they
those tend to be space-based and
yeah,
maybe ET. So the question is, for instance, could you see tails? Could you see tails with advanced LIGO and Newton star?
This is a good point. The tail term will contribute
early.
About 400 cycles for LIGO.
for a neutron star binary.
1.5 should be.
1.5 should be possible. Then you detect the tail effect quite easily, immediately, I would say, from parameter solution. Like,
yeah,
3PN, we contribute for with about one or a few cycles.
Now, what is it? We expect that, but there are no decisive quantitative studies showing. I mean, as far as I know.
Yeah, I think, in fact, nobody has looked at parameter estimation of the PN terms, imposing that you know the masses. Like, the neutron, suppose that you know that they were neutrons and neutron stars, which I don't know why you should assume that.
Well, you know the poles are masses.
Because if we don't know the masses, I think I agree with Ricardo that it's not very easy.
Well, one thing that can help is repeated detections. If you have 30 detections in a year,
yeah,
all of them at 20, 30 SNR, then they all add up and they give you consistency.
Because the PN is the same for the PN coefficient is the same for all. It's the same functional form.
You take the product of the PDFs and then helps, even if you don't know the masses. Mm-hmm. But true, I mean, nobody's looking at it.
Yeah, I think nobody's looking.
Yes.
We are here, but can go into coffee break. Is that what it is?
Yeah, coffee break.
So the next talk is at the
dynamic.
We can anticipate it a little.
What's that?
We could do it a little earlier.
Oh, the coffee break?
No.
I'll meaning?
10:40?
I see. Okay.
We go to Blatcher.
Whatever people want to do.
Shouldn't we thank the speakers? I'm subverting the schedule.
Sure.
Yeah.